I'm just here to make a few links between the different speakers tonight. And the event, obviously, is a fairly significant one, I think, on a number of scores. And certainly, I think it represents a significant piece of work from Jeff McNeil. Jeff works in the School of People, Environment and Planning as a resource planner. He's a couple of quick mentions. He's a geographer, like myself, and one of the incredible things about the book, if you get to have I'm sure Jeff will tell you to buy it, but even if you don't buy it, if you have a look in it, you'll see the quality of the maps in there is outstanding. And I was lucky enough to be in the office next to Jeff for about 4 or 5 years, I think, and I watched these maps go through various iterations, and they, you know, ripped up bits of paper thrown over his shoulder and all sorts of things, but the final product is really quite stunning. So as a geographer, I feel very impressed with the quality of the maps you have in there, Jeff. The other thing I think has hit a school that has become very apparent in terms of Jeff is he's a real polymath, a modern-day one, in the sense that his day job is really resource and environmental planning, and he's done some stellar work, some cutting-edge work on the way in which policy operates in the environmental sphere here in New Zealand, but also offshore internationally, done work, comparative work with Europe and so on. So that's his day job. This work that he's doing isn't even his part-time job, because he's also published some really interesting and quite cutting-edge work on music education as well. So he covers that. He obviously plays at a very high level the bassoon himself. And this particular piece of work came out of family connections that I'm sure he'll talk about, and represents the quality of the scholarship in the book is just outstanding, and he's been able to translate those sorts of skills across such a broad range of different areas. I'll hand over to Jeff to give a talk about the battle that the book is based on. Just following that, the Mayor, Grant Smith, is sitting in the front row here. He will do the formal launch of the book. Then Russell...
Paul might turn up from Summerhill.
Probably stuck halfway up the hill. And then Jeff will tie things up before he lets us loose on the bar over on the other side there. So I don't want to say anything more. I'll just hand over to Jeff and... Look forward very much to the lecture he's about to give us. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you very much, Glenn, for that introduction. I can't say I actually recognised myself there, but that's very nice. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming this evening. Thank you to the Mayor for graciously agreeing to launch the book. Very much appreciated. And to friends and colleagues, it's great to see you all. Thank you. Glenn's left his mask here if you want to. Right, as a historical geographer, well really I'm a geographer, but I do into history as it turns out now. What I want to do is talk about what I call New Zealand's great forgotten victory, the Battle of Messines, 1917. And I'm arguing that it's actually one of the more important battles, and it's been forgotten in New Zealand. It needs to be rediscovered and remembered. The Battle of Messines is the great forgotten victory. It was fought between the ambivalent bloodbath of the Somme in September 1916 for the New Zealanders and their disaster at Passchendaele in October 1917. It opened on the 7th of June, hence the date on this victory machine gun, and it officially concluded a week later on the 14th. We think of First World War as being sort of blood and guts and mud. This one was fought in late spring. There's dust and thirst. That's not mud. That's the biggest problem for many of the troops. It was completed for the New Zealanders within about 5 hours on the first day, although the division was to actually re-enter the battle a bit later, a couple of days later, and continued fighting until a day after the official finish of the battle. What I want to talk about is sort of three themes to get you through this evening. One is that I'm arguing that it's an important battle for New Zealand, one that needs to be remembered. Secondly, I just want to get, as a geographer, the sense of contrast and scales. For me, which is one of the really big discoveries and aha moments, was the unimaginable numbers of men and weapons involved over incredibly small areas of land. And thirdly, I want to address the sort of still popular and popular imagination of the lions led by donkeys, that in fact these were ordinary men in extraordinary circumstances. They were fighting, however, a state-of-the-art battle. I'd argue that they were not led by donkeys, but in fact, you won't get into the details, read the book, that there may have been some self-regarding individuals. All right. Here we have the division. Most of, or two-thirds of it, on the march in October 1917. Why am I showing this? I'm arguing that this battle was significant for New Zealand. It was the largest commitment to the field of all three infantry brigades committed on the first day. And with the newly formed 4th Brigade, that was then put into fight a couple of days later, something like about 19,000 men were included in the total New Zealand division. That's not just infantry, that's everybody. But that's the New Zealand commitment. Put it in perspective, in a country with 1 million people, it was the equivalent, the New Zealand division, oops, that's the wrong number, New Zealand division was around about New Zealand's 5th largest city. It's worth putting in context as well that 100,000 New Zealand men went overseas to fight, which is about the size of Auckland. So we can really get a sense of just how big a commitment New Zealand was making. But back to the victory. This was not just a victory. It was a significant victory, and one which is complete in a war that up until then had various ambivalent successes at best. Gallipoli had been a fail, Somme, bloody and for very limited gains. And in fact, there was even doubts that, in fact, you could actually have an offensive to be successful. This one was able to do it. And so he said, great captures in the Messines Ridge. It was a great thing, a great day for New Zealand and Ireland. That's another story for later, read the book. It's great work of colonial troops, mines, phenomenally light casualties, which is a theme I'll come back to. It was a victory celebrated at the time and proudly recalled afterwards. And the men were very proud of their success at Messines. Brigadier General Bill Braithwaite, who commanded the 2nd Brigade, Infantry Brigade, the success of the brigade has had a marked effect on the spirits and morale of all ranks. Everyone is much elated by the successes and not without good cause. And so here we have 2nd Lieutenant Pat Hannah, the cartoonist, drawing a poke in the eye of the sharp stick. The Hindenbeger in the Seines was it. A little later, in 1918, in a Brockton camp in England, training camp for the Rifle Brigade, the Rifle Brigade got the German prisoners of war in the nearby camp to build a scale model of the battle. And this was after all the disasters of Passchendaele. So, you know, this had a special place. They weren't going to be taking the Seines again. And I'd have to say the model's still there, mostly. It's under turf. It was dug out a couple of years ago and put back and recovered. Right, and at the time, after the war, straight afterwards, this is the New Zealand Battle Memorial. It's one of four unveiled. It's one in 1924 on the sites of significant New Zealand victories. And this one's in the honour of the men of New Zealand Division, the Battle of Messines, 7th to 14th of June 1917. So it was one of the four big successes as far as New Zealand was concerned. And afterwards, many sought to bask in its glory. Here we have the firebrand, John A. Lee, who, in the Labour Party, very much a socialist. He was a bona fides hero for the 1935 Labour government, which was rather strong on First World War pacifists. And so he was trotted out. He'd got his DCM here. He'd also written his autobiographical novel, it's in the library. It's his account of the Battle of Messines and what's in it. It caused quite a furore at the time, but not for the reasons we'd think. I'll let you find it for yourself. Others just wished they were there. And here we have Sid Holland. And it's very interesting. I would argue that in his... he'd sort of say that he'd been a... What is it? In the Who's Who from 1956 when he was Prime Minister, Signal Field Artillery, 1st NZF, invalided after Messines. During the Battle of Messines, he was seriously ill and invalided. It's sort of dropping in the name of association, vicarious victory, because when you read it, he was actually in hospital with high debtors, which cost him his life. But nevertheless, that was never made clear, and it's something which even biographies, more recent ones, which historians should be aware of, fall into the trap of. In Germany, it was a bit of a different story. Well, I should sort of say, too, that, however, that more recently, Messines has largely dropped off the New Zealand public awareness and memory, which is why I think there's the need for the book. In the Ministry of Culture and Heritage survey of WW100, it actually didn't kind of register. Everyone thinks of, the public thinks of World War I as being Gallipoli, which has had about 20,000 men in total over the 9 months. And in fact, in their survey, they didn't even ask about Messines. If Messines has come of significance, it was only this the other week, where, because Messines Road in Wellington, named after the battle, is of course where the Russian embassy is. And so, hence the little name. So, it got us all 5 minutes of fame and stuff. In Germany at the time, here we have the funeral straight afterwards, it was originally painted in the press as a sort of a success that had held. The Germans had held the British from getting through. But the reality was far, far different. Hermann von Kuhl, the historian, called it Germany's darkest day of the Western Front, the sheer loss of men. The horror also, at the time, that with determination the British could have broken through. And also there was this strong bitterness at a loss of this ridge, which had been incredibly bloodily fought for back in 1914. Today it's completely forgotten. I haven't yet to find any German who knows anything about it. In fact, they're not really into World War I at all. If Messines is remembered at all, it's as a curiosity, pretty much, apart from those who've got ancestors who fought there. It's for the 19 mines that blew at the start of the battle. Made a great big hole, and you can still see the holes, and you can still see this one, and a fair few others if you actually go and do the battlefield visits, as we have. But it points out, despite popular imagination for those New Zealanders who think so, that no New Zealanders were involved in the digging of those. They were all actually further south at Arras. But it doesn't, it might spoil the story a wee bit. The mines were about one of the largest explosions across this 15 kilometres of battlefield. And it's sort of been the horrors of war. This has been it. With the sort of talks of 10,000 men are German blown sky high, I've done the calculations and there's no way that more than 800 of them actually would have been killed, which is a few, but actually a small proportion of those who actually did die. I'd argue, and just aware of the time, I might sort of cut a wee bit to the chase in some of this, that Messines should be remembered by military historians. The storm that had begun back in the 1st of July had been disastrous for the British, as we all know, but also for the Germans. And both sides realised they couldn't go on like they had been fighting, and they had to be more clever about it. Already, and they're thinking about it all the time, I think this is one of the important points we need to be aware of. And already when the New Zealanders, who were rather late to the party, going in to fight at the Somme in September, middle of September, they actually had quite different tactics than what had happened on the 31st of July. Rather, both sides had gone off to lick their wounds over Christmas, to work out new doctrine and new tactics to try and, one, to defend if you're German, two, to actually win a battle should you actually be the British. And so, in fact, Messines can be seen as, for the time, as a very modern battle with new doctrine, tactics, technology and application. I'm not going to spend much time on this except to point out this is a captured, a copy of a captured German document released on the 1st of May 1917. It sets out the new German elastic defence, as it's called, where you rely, this is the front lines up here, in New Zealand, there's British up here. You can suddenly see that's coming through very clearly on the picture that all these machine guns just dotted over a kilometre You've got the front line, support bits of bunkers and so forth, pillboxes, then a second line, and actually there's a third line, possibly a fourth, and just kept on going. And so that's sort of how they arranged it. The idea would be that when it came too much, these men would actually kind of retreat back, not retreat, retire would be the better way. At the same time, that is drawing the British in, a bit like what we see or saw happen to the Russians in a way more in Ukraine, that the further you go, the more you get bogged down. And that's the German thinking, and which at a critical moment you'd have a counterattack by a Landgraf division, and they'd come charging through and wipe up the English. Well, that's the idea. The British were thinking about what to do, and they said actually we just solve this partly by a far more clever and more intensive use of artillery. Massive, massive use of artillery. And it's worth bearing in mind in the First World War that something like 85% of casualties were artillery. Bullets and bayonets are actually a very small part of the deal. I mean, getting killed either way is not much fun, I would have thought, but this is really artillery. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And what we'd actually seen at Messines was for the first time what was called all arms warfare, where we actually had, like we do today, we had aeroplanes, two of them assigned to the 2nd ANZAC, spotting and giving advice to the artillery so they can get better shots in against the Germans. So that was all very, very novel at the time. As I say, this was a, and there were various other bits as well. They changed how they fought. They sort of had a, realising that they're advancing in waves behind the creeping barrage, that you needed to have, if the barrage got ahead of you, that you needed to have devolved command and control. And so there's this top-down, bottom-up concept. And we have platoons, as they're now known today. And so you'd throw about 40 men, or 36 plus 4, of an officer, a Lewis gun, rifle grenades, hand grenade throwers, grenadiers, and riflemen. And they'd sort of each have a, they'd be devolved down to actually have a lot of responsibility and a lot of awareness of what's expected of them. So if their officers and NCOs were killed, the men could keep going. So this is a real big change, and the concept remains today. And we see this in the, this is the photo that everyone ever uses for the Battle of Messines, the New Zealand one. We see them in sort of groups, if you squint a wee bit, but sort of groups of four, really, in the artillery position. There's, whoops, we'll just keep going. Right, the other one was this gained more novel technology. And so we had them with new tanks. The found that the previous ones, the Mark IIs, had a tendency to either catch fire or the bullets would go through the metal. These things were far more invincible. So that was being used, although they hadn't really worked out how to use them properly. And they actually went out, this is the first time they were used in the Battle of Messines. And it's worth noting too, for those interested in tanks, should you ever be, that the first time tanks ever were used was also for New Zealand Division back at the Somme. Right. I guess you might be wondering at the back of your head, it's all very well being talking about the Messines, but where is it? You'd have to wonder, and I wondered. And if you were back in sort of June, 8th of June 1917 in Wellington, and looking at the Evening Standard, the best you could get, along with all the headlines about some great extraordinary light losses, is this map with the very unhelpful advice that Wieskade is a small village 4 miles south of Ypres and 2 miles northwest of Messines, which is shown in the map. Well, that's going to really help. In case you wondered, it's there, but you know, who would have thought? And are you any the wiser? No. Oh, well, we'll blow it up. Any the wiser? No. Right, so let's... There it is there, Sam. I'm a geographer. I like maps. Right, let's have another go. And that first map is actually just in there. So we can sort of see London, Paris, Brussels, Lille just in France, and it's in here. So let's blow that up a bit more. And this is really washed out coloured. I'm very sorry about this, folks. So here we have, it's just down here, it's now called Mazen, by the way, just to really confuse people, because of the Dutch still, they haven't much run out. Here's the Flemish Plain, wasn't much use, I'll just give you a wee bit of advice on that, because we're going to run out of time, is that this was all flooded to stop the Germans coming through. By the way, you can't see it, so I'll explain. The green line was from the beginning of 1915 through to the Battle of the Seams, and the red line was what they had achieved by the end of 1917. So the Allies had sort of moved a little to the east. You can see, too, this sort of, it's all very, very flat, apart from this range of hills just here. And here's Passchendaele, here's Mazan. Let's look up a bit closer. So from up there, boom, right up here. So here we are, here's Passchendaele, it's modern spelling, Ypres, Mazan, or here's Wetzikate. It's a bit funny. Right, so we're talking about this little bit here. And this is the battle. It's a very, very simple battle. It was a very clearly defined, limited objective one. What we've got is, it's colours a wee bit faded, but we can see the blue lines is that it's a salient, which means it's a bulge. Its blue line is where the British were, up here is the Germans. And all that was really intended was on the day, they'd go through first, originally, just to the black line here. And that's how it stayed, and all the planning was based on. And then just before, the whole thing took off a month before, Field Marshal Haig had the bright idea of saying, let's be more adventurous and go out to the next line of trenches, the Oster-Werner line, which is the German second line. Note that behind that there's another set of German lines, the Wurnitzen line, and they're busy digging another one just here as well. So, yeah, how long would it have taken to get to Berlin is a good guess. And just put it in perspective, 3 corps, 10 corps, 9 corps, 2nd Anzac, and New Zealand is just in this little bit, and here, about 1.5 kilometres wide, which is an interesting thought, let's blow that up. Right, under General Alexander Godley of Godley's, he's the nephew of Godley's head, down in Christchurch, Littleton, and so there's, he had 3 divisions, each of about 16,000 men. So you start to see the immensity of what's involved. The 25th, which is English, called the Chums by the New Zealand, because they're all Northern English. Hello, Chum. That's what they called them. The New Zealand division, the 3rd Australian, who were in for their first fight. I guess it's just a little aside that there was the saying by the New Zealanders that at the march past, the English marched past, the New Zealanders walked past and the Australians got past. Didn't have a great admiration for them. Right, okay, whoops, we've jumped it, you pressed the wrong button. Here we go, here's the New Zealand bit, about 1.5 kilometres for our 16,000 men. Here's the British, here's the Australians, and here's the black line, which is the top of the ridge. There's a ridge here, you can see it more in this oblique picture. Here's the New Zealand front line. They went first to this thing called here's the front line. They went to this little line behind it, a lot of trenches. The blue line doesn't show, the brown one just before the village, bulged around the village, put the yellow line funny up to the black, and then put strong points out beyond. The green line was for the Australians in the afternoon as the bolt-on add-on, which was not a great idea. Right. What they were facing was a mixture of the... I should have said that the New Zealanders the line divisions were to attack at about 3 o'clock in the morning, 3:10 to be precise, that was British summer time, and the Australians in 3:10 in the afternoon. Right, just a wee bit of time, we're making the details, but you can see these round dots here are actually German machine guns. There's the New Zealanders here, and this is what they're facing, along with a whole lot of 6 anti-tank guns, because they actually rather worked out about the British tanks by the end. But they hadn't realised that the new tanks were that much more armoured. Right. Opposite was the 40th Saxon Division, holding most of this area. But they actually got really worn out, and at the very last minute, they were replaced by the 3rd Bavarian Division, which aren't actually Bavarians. It's one of the anomalies that which won't get into the history, but it's that for a while the Rhineland Palatinate is actually west of the Rhine, up opposite Heidelberg, and they all drink wine, and half of them are Catholic, half Protestant, and they don't eat sausage as much. They don't drink beer. So they're actually an incredibly different lot. And as an aside for any historian, it turns out only recently that these, that Landau, of which this area, actually provided the troops for 15 Panzer, which shot up my great-uncle in the Second World War. Is that's one of the main troops in the desert and also in Italy. So I think we should actually twins country, sort of the Palatinate in New Zealand. Interesting history. Right, moving on. Right, the idea was to hit for the British some massive guns, just overpowering the numbers, and there's just a following minute by minute, that every 3 minutes there'd be a lift. So the basic sort of drop of artillery and the troops would just be following it. And it worked extremely well. The New Zealanders said that the barrage was so tight you could lean against it. It's a bit of an exaggeration. I wouldn't try it. But you get the idea. The problem, though, is if the barrage got ahead of you, because then the Germans would sort of pop their heads up. They trained to get their machine guns in action within 30 seconds, and then it was all over. So you had to have those platoon movements that I talked about earlier. Right, the New Zealanders were helped by a number of German mistakes. They had not fully employed the elastic defence model. And so the front line was still firmly held as opposed to be sort of very sort of loosely held, which is basically turned into a death trap, which is why the Saxons in the first instance got flattened. As well, the Bavarians had been trained as this counterattack or Eingriff division. They had really trained for the job. They worked out there's two ways the British could come. They worked it out how best to defend these two different ways. All that the commander, von Weniger, could do was say, plan A, fall A, fall B. And everything would just fit in like clockwork. And at the last minute, the Germans said, right, the Saxons have worn out. The Eingriff division is going in to hold the trenches. And the First Guards Reserve to just come up from Arras would then to be the Eingriff, the counterattack. And it was just beyond them. They didn't know what to do. And my argument would be that, in fact, if the Germans had stuck to the original plan, it could have been a very different day for the British, and the New Zealanders. Okay, we are moving on, and we better do it fed fast. Here's what we're looking at. Here's Messines today. And that we're standing on a hill here called Hill 63, because it's 63 metres above sea level. Imagine the abusive names. And we're looking across to Mazen and the Ridge, and it tails off here, they've got all of it here. New Zealand Memorial is a good bit in the middle, and there's this road. So that's what we're looking at. New Zealanders just had to go up to the top and then take the village. Completely rebuilt, of course. Two brigades, one on each side. Two battalions, each about 800 men doing that. There's the memorial in the middle. That's the front line. That was the New Zealand trenches. As you can see, there's a little creek there. And they just had to go up the hill. Not much to it, you think. And in fact, for the main part, it wasn't. This is actually from the German side, looking down. So you can see there's quite a steep drop. All this was actually this ridge here. The low one is the front line up through back here. And you can see there's a whole village behind it, just low. So you can see on the geographer and the, sort of this layout of the land, you know, it becomes so important. Right, this is what we looked at, 3 o'clock in the morning. Each of those blocks is about 160 men, which is pretty mind-boggling. So over about a kilometre, a bit more than that, about 1,200 metres, and they're just going up here. That's 8,000 men, probably, which is, I find, incredible. A mine went off up here, the Ontario mine. There was supposed to be one down here, but it was discovered back in 1916. And to this day, there was something like about 4 British miners, but probably about the same number of German miners, and 25 tonnes of explosives still there. Underground. One did go bang in 1955 through the south, killed a cat. Right, I don't think we'll read all of this out, it's going to run out of time, but on the left, in great fact, when it went off at 3:10, the all mines went off within about a minute of each other. a bit off like a light eruption at the throat of some volcano, momentary flash of the red flame, like the red of blood orange, brilliant against the black smoke that impressed the vision. In quick succession, other ruins, five or six in numbers, heave themselves sky with awesome effect, making the ground rock and quiver. And it's Malcolm Bevan. It was like pictures of hell, great billows of blood-red flames curling up hundreds of feet high, and the ground shook like a leaf. Cheerful stuff. And then they kind of marched up like this, except it was far less organised. It was in the dark, and it was smoke, and there was gas, and everything else. Good luck. They moved to the first bit, it doesn't take long. They actually got to the German first trenches and into the support parts of them within 7 minutes. I'm not talking much at all. Then they went up to the edge of town, the brown line, and that took them in total about 45 minutes. So this lot dug in, the ones behind then leapfrogged them, went to the next bit. We'll skip some of that one, but it was a bit grim, and this is one of the few occasions where smoking is good for you. I was digging in and had to sit down in my hole to light a fag when overtoppled a chap on either side of me, both dead, shot through the head. At least in a 6 foot and fairly safe down. So there you go. And there's a lot of these stories of bad luck and the rest of it. It's very sobering reading the men's diaries, I have to say. This is what you're looking at. This is on the way from the blue line, it's down here, up to the brown line. This is the church, by the way. When you think about it, the church is just bricks, well, those ones are. And this is what a pulverised pile of bricks looks like. That's the village. Lieutenant Daniel Hach, within seconds of leaving the company, he's a German company command shelter, we saw how the English skirmishing lines were coming through our position. I let the few men who were still with me fire until the British, i.e. New Zealanders, reached about 20 paces. Since capture would have been certain, I then gave an order back to the command post to advise that the position's been overrun. About this time, too, that Sam Freckleton won his Victoria Cross, and I actually had a bit of a problem with this one, but there's arguments, and we'll never resolve it. Basically, he was supposed to stop here at the edge of the town. He actually charged through, thought to be believed, to the church, and this constant New Zealand barrage coming here, took out a couple of machine guns. What's not to mention quite so much that some of his mates went with him, including Dick Heed from Fielding, and they didn't make it. So, And then on to the yellow line. Just basically, they went straight through the village and took all these strong fortifications from behind. That's the town. Having dug in, they then faced the first of the German counterattacks, but didn't actually realise the time they were. I just thought it was part of the deal. But I was actually getting a bit hairy about here. We'll come to the Trommelschloss in a second, but around here, John O'Hee wins his DCM, and he writes about it in his novel, which, I mean, it's a bit of a lurid read, but it's very insightful in other ways. Ahead on the left was a strong point, and the machine guns were mowing down men like a swinging scythe mows tall grass. Fanwise, New Zealanders were lying dead, spread-eagled around the circle of traversing machine gun barrels. As he looked, three men stood erect at the end of the sag and ran forward, chuck, 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 chuck. One at a time, they were cut down, crumpled, forward, some soldiers still. Bloody hell, I'll fix those bastards. and he started to run at the strong point, and he took it. But which in itself is quite an amazing story, but I'll save that for another day. At the Trommelschloss, just to give a sense of what we're up against, was Hans von Kohlmüller, in charge of the 17th 2nd Battalion, actually, and realising that they're under heavy attack, he gave the order to his men, some have been saying, should we retire? He said, I didn't go to war to surrender the position I was entrusted to defend. Either I die here, or my troops and I shall be assisted by our support troops. For me, there's no question of relying on the support troops to come to our assistance. And so they fought on. Talk about an hour, at least as far as I can work out, and it gets a bit dodgy to work it out, to actually subdue this position, and it cost the concern taking it at least three quarters of its men, as it's in these others. When we hear about light casualties, it's relative for the time, the levels that we would not cope with at all now. Colin Miller actually got what took them out in the end was a spoke mortar which came up and blew them to bits. having then got through, they then dug in their black line. They'd actually achieved all they had to do. All they had to do then was put out some outposts on the black dotted line. The GGs went for a trot. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. One of the things that Godley really wanted to do is to have the cavalry ride, because he always wrote to the king about what a great job he was, and he was very, very proud of this. So in the morning, the Australian 4th Light Horse Regiment went for a trot long yet there. What they did, how they did, I have no idea. It doesn't make much sense, quite frankly. Anyway, they did. Then, getting ready for the second, in the afternoon, the Australians sort of lined up on the black line, a whole lot of them, and the Germans counterattacked. The guards finally formed up. It was a daft idea, completely stupid, and von Vranegger, the German commander, said, "Don't." And he had repeated phone calls back to Army headquarters, 4th Army, and then they said, "Do it." And so they did, and with, although we read in various articles about how the New Zealand and Australian rifles and machine guns did it, it was the artillery. But you'd notice, though, that actually, it comes here, that New Zealand strong posts were pretty close to some of these German trenches. That was only taken by a tank in it. So the Germans had their counter-attack. Basically, as shoots up Jan Joachim Ruhr, pictured here, the whole 2nd Battalion advanced line abreast, men three steps apart, grand sight with shell and shrapnel on the surging attack line. More and more shell bursts occurred, and men fell out here and there and more quickly. We also came under sustained English machine gun fire, but fortunately it was still too high, so the blue beams sizzled over our heads. I remember that I raised an ammunition box to protect my head, but I didn't think to protect my chest and body as well. Yeah. Right, he survived, though somewhat wounded, took time off afterwards to do it. Right, here's the green line. You can actually see it's pretty flat. And you can also see at this stage that the shells supporting artillery barrage are all over the place. So it's getting a bit dodgy at this stage. And it has to be said that actually no one had a clue what was going on, and it's a total mess. No one to this stage really worked it out. I've got parts of the story there. This is from a German field gun shelter. Looking out, so the Australians were sort of coming this way, and they really didn't stand too much of a chance. And as General Russell, the New Zealand officer commanding, said, "Directly a portion of the 4th Division went through. We never knew what was going on and did not know the position in front up to the moment we came out of the line," which is a bit of a worry. They had about a kilometre back. There's a bit of time here. Just that finished. There was the afternoon attack. It was a total, well, mixed success, let's say, that it didn't achieve all its objectives. We can see that, in fact, a whole lot of them up the north here got completely deflected through a whole lot of inspiration of the wrong sort, way up there, which meant that they'd, well, put this button again. And dragged these guys. So the whole of this area was never taken. In fact, it was only when the Germans gave up and relinquished it voluntarily about 3 days later that anything could happen. Total mess down here as well. And this is really important mess because, as no one knows, the two Anzac commander, Godley, gets more and more worried about what's going on once he realises that it takes an ages to do it. Nevertheless, it's all. I should have said that these artillery barrages are all run by clockwork. Once they start, they just keep going. You can't stop them or change the time. So 3:10, off they went. Some of them got there, some went up here, and some got lost and shot up here. And at 4:15, the barrage stopped in time to let the scouts go out. Eventually, and this is another trot for the GGs, or the mounted rifles go for a trot, I should say. So where they go, no one has a clue. I've tried to work it out. One of them writes, and it's quite a well-known quote, but I found the original, "Talk about the charge of the Light Brigade. The infantry said we were mad, and by Jove we were. We charged over barbed wire entanglements, over trenches, and what good we did, well, I don't know. You got a few men and a few horses killed. Well, actually, 7 wounded, 1 mortally men, 8 horses killed, 32 injured, and about a quarter of their total strength." So there you go. Just to get the gist of it, they started off over here. The Australians were still fighting to get the frontline trench, let alone the reserve. The New Zealand Otago's mounted rifles were supposed to get to here, just pushing it. And the only record I've got of them anywhere is actually about here. Yeah. So, The important thing was that Godley, the commander, could say that the cavalry had been for a trot, and he wrote to the king afterwards to say what a great, glorious job it was and what a fantastic job they did. Now, he's a horseman, you know, cavalry. Right. In the evening, just confusion and retreat. The only good part of the whole thing, really, is the British were concerned and sent Anzac, was that Godley had actually... his saving was that the Germans had already thought they'd lost. Both sides actually retreated. The Germans started retreating from what was left of them here, and as it became more and more confused, the Australians moved backwards as well. In fact, by about 3 o'clock in the morning, most of them were back here at the start line. They quickly realised what was going on, and then over the next day were able to sort of get back onto the green line for the main part. But it's a total cock-up. There's no two ways about it. This is actually important because it gives Godley a very bad dose of the worries, and he keeps the New Zealanders in position back on the black line and in the sand, which is a shell hole. The consequence is that the failure to thin in the afternoon had led to substantial casualties for the New Zealanders. They'd actually got through the first part incredibly lightly. And this was seen as totally unnecessary by the New Zealand commanders, brigade commanders. So you've got Braithwaite, who's pretty articulate. The casualties suffered by the brigade during the attack were comparatively light, but after the ridge was taken, casualties increased enormously from the shell fire, and especially enfilades that's coming from the side, from further down. He then continues, with so many collected together and congested the area, it was inevitable that casualties should increase. And unfortunately, this proved to be the case, which is code for you got it wrong. The casualties of this brigade increased from about 250 during the attack to 900 before the brigade was relieved on the evening of the 9th. So this is, and the only reason I could really see is why that they were kept there was that Godley was so nervous and wanting to keep his reputation for success, basically was being spooked by the counterattacks, wanted a belt and braces insurance plan. And then once he'd got all the more so, when he realised he didn't know what was going on, you know, just nearly there, kind of filling up for Russell, who's not really here. They went on to the final bit, La Bastille, we'll read about that in the book, and then they got to the Passion Vale, which is the disaster it was. Despite the claims of extraordinary light casualties, the scene was no walkover. It wasn't as bad as it could have been. In fact, it was much, much better to start off with. But in the end, it's been... Harper works out about 1,000 men were killed over those 3 days. 3,000 odd were wounded. 389 of them are actually in the 32 war grave cemeteries near Messines, and 60 are buried here in Messines Ridge alone. But most of them actually have no known grave. In Messines Ridge Memorial here records 529 names of these men. It was that that inspired me when I came across it. Pretty much by accident, these are just kind of names that I thought I'd actually get into this book and write about it. So this is the one battle that no one ever paid any attention to. So it's for these men, together with the 3,000 wounded and their families, that I wrote Taking the Ridge, because I believe this story needs to be known. Thank you. Have I got time for questions, or do you?
Yeah, no, I do questions generally.
Okay, thanks. Perhaps I'll just take a few questions if there's any, might be the easiest, because Russell didn't make it. Oh, you are. Going to have a quick say then, Russell. A few words?
Yes.
Okay.
What I wanted to do, you've heard Jeff's account of his book, but I wanted to literally bring the book here, which I've done. And it's moderately heavy, as Jeff knows. And what I wanted to do, metaphorically anyway, is to open this book up for you. So starting just with a greeting, Tēnā koutou, Tēnā koutou, Tēnā koutou, katoa. And it's certainly an honour to speak here today. Jeff is, as you've probably gathered from his talk, both a physical and a human geographer. I don't know if it's a rare combination, but it's certainly a very powerful one. And he also has a great enthusiasm for technology. So I thought I would particularly illustrate those aspects from his book, taking care to avoid revisiting topics that he's already covered. And at Jeff's suggestion, some years ago, before I got into editing this book, which is where I come into it, the two of us, Jeff and I, visited Peter Jackson's Passchendaele exhibition in Whanganui-Tara, a more modest supplement to Jackson's blockbuster Gallipoli exhibition at Te Papa. And what we found there was an impressive assemblage of vintage vehicles, as you'd expect of Peter Jackson, dioramas, installations, and photo montages, all on hand to illustrate what the action would have looked like on the Western Front. More helpful than those, though, was Jeff's commentary on the photos. And I'm very sorry that I won't be able to ever be guided around the actual battlefield by Jeff, because I think it would be quite revelatory. A particular thing that stuck with me was his explanation of how those brave souls in the artillery platoons that you've seen in the slide there would duck and weave as they made their way up the ridge to the enemy trenches. And if you darted too far ahead, as clearly some were tempted to, you would run into the barrage from your own side, from artillery located far behind you. So you didn't want to dart too far ahead. With that in mind, I want here just to acknowledge my father's cousin, Albert William Gresham Poole, of the Wellington Infantry Battalion, 10-3058, who survived Messines but was killed at Passchendaele on 4th October 1917, lest we forget, Kawara Tatu. Jeff also gave me a crash course on the complexities of the trench system as it applied to the Western Front. The trenches had names, and the rule seems to have been that they had to, in the Messines sector, they had to start with the letters O or U and be as bizarre as possible. Thus we get October Trench, Oxygen Trench, Owl Trench, Owl Support Trench, etc. in the O's. And then Ulcer Trench, Ulcer Sap, Unbearable Trench, Uncanny Trench, and even Ungodly, is that to do with godly, in the U's. I suppose the real reason for these bizarre names is that even hearing them down a crackly field telephone line, you'd know which is which, a bit like the aviation alphabet. Equally confusing, at least to me, were these lines, which you've seen illustrated on Jeff's slides, with their rather garish colours: red line, yellow line, brown line, blue line, black line, and finally black dotted line. You'd really need to be able to see that there were dots. Only a trained geographer like Jeff would be able to plot these zigzags on the map. Luckily for the readers of his book, he and Robert Gibb have provided a series of excellent maps to clarify the position of trenches and lines. And for me, the images that are done with LIDAR, L-A-D-I-A-R, are among the most fascinating of all, also used, of course, for archaeology. And working out the Battle of Messines is a matter of archaeology now, among other things. Jeff has already shown you some of the diary entries from the men, and I would say that he's expertly selected from and interwoven a great multiplicity of sources, everything from official regimental histories through to radio interviews given much later in life by ordinary soldiers. One rule in using these accounts is that you have to practice the thing historians call source criticism. The neater and tidier the accounts look individually, the less likely they are to be reflecting reality. Many of the men on both sides kept diaries or wrote letters or even memoirs. One man who leaps off the page is a fellow called Cuthbert Free. What a good name. A captain in 2nd Canterbury Company and a former law student. He's particularly exuberant in his letter to his mother before the Battle of Messines. "Once more we're for it. In 6 hours' time we'll have gone over the bags again. I'm as excited as ever. War still retains all its thrills when it comes to real battles." As Jeff has said, a huge feature of day one at Messines was the mines, and this is where we get into the technology. These miners, the miners who construct the tunnels, work from sometimes considerable distances away from the place where the mine was to be put, and weeks, if not months, ahead of the action, so as to place large amounts of high explosives under enemy strong points. masses and masses of ammonite, and as Jeff says, it hasn't all gone off. And I think you said the one that did go off in 1955 killed a cow, right? Yeah, could have been worse. The use of mining to destroy enemy defences from underneath has been around since ancient times. Even the Vikings knew about it. But it's become for us nowadays in our own minds particularly associated with the Western Front. The background to that is that lines of trenches at the outset of the war had been speedily established all the way from the Belgian coast to the Swiss border, and they were designedly very difficult to breach. If you went over the top or hopped the bags in classic fashion, you stood an excellent chance of becoming a casualty. So the challenge was to find a way of softening the enemy up from underneath before you did the surface onslaught. Here's a rather charming anecdote connected with this that Jeff tells. One of the earliest British attempts at mining was at Armentier in 1915. The miners dug a shaft. The shaft filled with water because, unfortunately, the water table was very high in this area, a very soggy part of Europe, this. The Saxons, in other words, the German force, watching opposite from their front line and seeing this work going on, put up a blackboard with a notice chalked in rather good English. No good your mining. We've tried. It can't be done. They were described by the British as rather friendly Saxons. And this was, of course, one of a number of moments of cordiality during this war of attrition on the Western Front that have entered into legend, like the story of the singing of Silent Night, Holy Night, and so forth. But the Saxons, however friendly they might have been, were only partially right about the feasibility of mining. Thanks to differences in the geology, tunnels were fully feasible elsewhere, as was shown by the New Zealanders, the Pioneer Company at Oka in 1916, and then the Canadians at Messines in 1917. The mines on the whole were a great success. Major General Sir Charles Harrington, a member of the British General Staff, had made a promise on the eve of the attack, which the mines fully lived up to. He said, "Gentlemen, I do not know if we shall change history tomorrow, but we shall certainly alter the geography." I should also here give a word to our very own Major Bob Wilson, the sandhill farmer from Rangitike, who writes in his memoir that he registered the initial impact as three sharp shocks of earthquake. I feel this is a very sort of New Zealand way of thinking about these massive blasts. The second technological thing that I wanted to talk about a bit, without once again duplicating what Jeff said, is the use of tanks. We have a diarist, Private Jack Lynch, who juxtaposes these old and new technologies in this diary in a fascinating way. He says, "As we stand here, waiting about in the glaring heat, we notice some tanks collecting nearby and a battery of 18-pounder guns galloping up. The horses halt in a cloud of dust, the guns are swung round, horses unhitched and galloped back." So here we have horses and tanks side by side. I think it was Winston Churchill who observed that in the First World War, extraordinary juxtapositions of the ancient and the ultramodern were regularly to be seen, as if you had men with bows and arrows fighting shoulder to shoulder with men armed with RPGs. The tank was a brand new British invention, prompted by the stalemate of trench warfare, and in February 1915, someone that we've heard of, First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, created what was called the Landships Committee to investigate a mechanical solution to the problem. They weren't called landships for ships for public consumption because that might have tipped the Germans off to what was being invented, hence the use of the totally misleading word tank, which we still use today. These tanks were very underpowered. They could do about a mile an hour, 1.6 kilometres an hour. Soldiers on foot could easily keep up with them. One infantryman, quoted by Jeff, says that even harnessed to a garden roller, he could beat the tanks in the race. which sounds bad, but actually it was, although not officially part of army doctrine, it was jolly useful for soldiers anywhere near these tanks because they provided useful protection. And a German soldier, whom Jeff quotes, testifies in his diary that, I quote, "The enemy assault troops, protected by their tanks, could get quite close to our position. The enemy now stood like furious wild tigers in front of our shell holes and, supported by the machine guns and the tanks, blindly shot straight in. It was impossible to think of holding our position." The competition for best name among the tanks, because I do like these names, would have to be won by a tank called Rumble Belly. And I think if you'd been inside Rumble Belly at the time, the reason for the name would be fully appreciated. Also good names are Lucifer and Our Emma, perhaps a sort of Yorkshire-Lancashire name there, and you can guess that that was a female tank, although I won't go further into that. Rumble Belly was commanded by the British-American war hero Lieutenant Tertius Frank Vance Agnew, MC. Vance Agnew had enlisted in 1914. He claimed to be 40, and he was in fact 46 at the time, but maybe it's rather hard to tell. He started with horses, so he was part of this juxtaposition too, in a cavalry regiment, but was soon moved on to the tanks. A very good decision on the part of some high command. The tanks were fully active at Messines, but started turning back at 4 p.m. That wasn't enough for Vance Agnew. He was never short of energy and initiative, and he kept Rumble Belly in play for 20 more minutes. Could have been his undoing, because it was about that time that the exhaust pipe got too hot altogether and set fire to the camouflage, the leafy sort of camouflage on the roof of the tank. Rumble Belly, fully in open ground, about to lose its concealment. But then Vance Agnew's corporal ran up the back of the tank with a fire extinguisher instead of putting it out. As Vance Agnew recalled in his outstanding memoir, Veteran Volunteer, well worth a read, "Not to be outdone by my own corporal, I ran round to the exposed side of the tank and used my extinguisher there until it was exhausted." Result, fire extinguished. And for that action, Vance Agnew was awarded the MC. Various vainglorious claims were made by the enemy concerning the fate of these tanks. They really wanted to sort of poo-poo the tanks, and the honest diarist on the German side that I quoted before is a bit of an exception. Three different German batteries claimed to have put them out of action, but in reality, as Jeff says, the incapacitated tanks were ditched rather than hit by shells. It was the terrain, the soggy terrain, that took them out rather than munitions. The technology on both sides had a long way to go. Now, and I'll conclude with another figure whom Jeff has just briefly mentioned, Samuel Frickleton, and tell you a bit more of his story, because really quite remarkable, I think. One of the most remarkable characters, I think, to emerge from Jeff's book. He was a New Zealand Scots fellow, Lance Corporal Samuel, better known as Sam Frickleton, VC of the 3rd Rifle Brigade. Sam didn't keep a diary, he didn't write memoirs, and we know of him mostly from newspaper reports. He was quite a modest fellow. I think Frickleton gives us an idea of how this battle was fought, because on the one hand there was a matter of doctrine, but then there was also the idea of using your initiative. And Frickleton, even though, as Jeff says, undoubtedly his section incurred casualties, very serious casualties, he was implementing that principle of using initiative within a framework of doctrine. He was born in 1891, emigrated from Scotland in 1913 with four brothers and one sister, carpenter by trade, but went coal mining on the west coast before the war, living at Blackball, where his mother ran a boarding house. He and his brothers had a reputation for fighting, but I would say that they wouldn't have been the only ones. Their mother was a fighter in her own right. She went public in deploring Labour Party resistance to conscription, which Jeff has alluded to. And that would be quite a statement if you were living in Blackpool. It's not a Blackpool, I mean, it's not a place where I would choose to kind of flaunt my political views too much. She told her five sons it was their duty to, to enlist. She herself also wanted to contribute to the war effort by nursing, though it sounds as if that she wasn't seen to do that. By sending all five sons to the war, she forfeited a combined income of £20 a week that they were paying her. That's no small income. A Scottish cousin of hers said that she didn't need to wet a finger, what we would say, lift a finger, because these sons took care of her so well. So quite a sacrifice for her to send these five sons to war. Our son went to Gallipoli first and was invalided at home. While recuperating, he presented a pair of his army socks for auction in aid of the soldiers' tobacco fund in Westport, saying that these socks had seen action at Anzac Cove. I don't know how much money they fetched. He returned to the war in 1916 at age 25, probably only just recuperated, now serving on the European front. In the assault on the scene on day one, he and his rifle section somehow slipped past the German strong point at the entrance to the town. As Jeff said, it's rather a mystery how they did, but nonetheless that's what happened. 15 minutes into the action, he was slightly wounded in the thigh, but as Jeff tells, he would fight for another 5 hours that day until a severe wound in the arm put him all to come back. And Frickleton observed that the whole British advance was being held up by enemy machine gun posts, so that if those posts remained in place, the British assault was not going to meet its objectives. So Frickleton and his section decided to rush the machine gun posts. The first of them lay 100 metres beyond the blue line, so that was already going too far, and because the 3rd Rifle Company was meant to end its advance at that point. And the second post was further on again beyond the blue line. In order to attain these machine gun posts, Frickleton and his section had to go through their own side's barrage. Some people said that they remembered seeing Frickleton and his men disappear into the kind of fog of war and at least mentally wave goodbye, thinking they would never see them again, and of course most of them they didn't. Frickleton's section overwhelmed the first enemy machine gun post, which was nestled in the ruins of the church. The second post lay at the crossroads, so it was more tricky because concealment was difficult for both sides. Rather than run up to it in plain view, Frickleton and his 3 mates, who had not fallen casualty, ducked through the houses to surprise it from the rear. With the second post dealt to, and now single-handed, Frickleton took out a 3rd post by sniping at the enemy soldiers rather than attempting to rush them. Obviously, as a rifleman, he was a crack shot. With the 3rd post dealt to, he finally took cover from the Allied barrage, which had been continuing the entire time. Diving into a shell hole, which is the refuge that people tended to find, he found 20 enemy soldiers down there ahead of him. They surrendered on the spot. And he took them all prisoner. I don't quite know how he did that. But he did. So for this action, he won the Victoria Cross, and longer term, after sitting in examination, a substantial promotion to second lieutenant. Frickleton was described by a contemporary as the greatest of all the daredevil racy men at the Western Front. A wonderful statement. So here we are, we've given you some tastes of the geographical, the technological and the human sides of Jeff's book. It just remains for me to say what a magnificent job he's done of commemorating this key battle. His mission has ended. Yours begins. I urge you to buy, and one of the copious copies over there, I urge you to buy and read this book and experience for yourself. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Russell.
I'll briefly take my mask off to invite the Mayor, Grant Smith, to come up and officially launch Jeff's book for us. Thank you.
Kia ora tātou, everybody, and look, thank you for the opportunity to say a few words. Jeff, you almost seem like a time traveller. It's almost like you've been there. Yeah. It's quite an incredible effort, actually. And you know, these books do take certainly a lot of research. And of course, you know, Jeff McNeil is a senior lecturer at Massey, previously, and I think it's come out in some of the maps and that, was previously a policy manager at Horizons, and I think that's where the maps are certainly coming into play. And of course, I've met you before many times with the Manawatu Symphonia and Youth Orchestra. But look, Taking the Ridge tells of the New Zealand Division's actions 105 years ago in the Battle of Messines, Belgium, in June 1917. And couple of things here, and Jeff's passed on a few notes to me, just from a Palmerston North and perhaps Muddle 2 perspective. But as he said, it was billed by the press at the time as a victory for very light casualties. But the Palmerston North casualties, when you put them into context of a city, or town really, of 10,000 people, was quite immense. Six deaths in the first 2 days and of the immediate battle, and four in the subsequent fighting that month. And for Palmerston North, at least 40 casualties, dead and wounded. So for a town of 2,200 households, that's nearly 2% of households that were directly affected by those casualties. Fielding and the Manawatu 2 also suffered. In total, 65 grieving families in Palmerston North and the Manawatu 2. And they're likely to have been more, as Jeff said there. Many, many were. Their graves were not found. So the casualties were anything but light. The battle is relevant to Palmerstonians and part of Palmerston North's history, and it's appropriate that we launch this tonight as we remember Anzac Day on Monday. And we need to know more about this battle because it has been largely forgotten. All those other battles are listed, but Mazin's was not. So Jeff's given you an outline of the book, its importance tonight. Taking the Ridge is distinctive. It's actually the first comprehensive battle account of the Battle of Mazin's. It's an historical geography, and the soldiers on both sides and where they've come from is being described. It describes the terrain in which they fought. It shows where the soldiers on both sides went and why in battle. And there's lots of maps. Lots of maps. And look, Taking the Ridge also tells the story of the wider battle, where the Anzac Corps, which the New Zealand Division was part of, provides detailed accounts around the experience of the German soldiers directly opposite the New Zealanders. And that's the first piece of New Zealand First World War history to do so. It helps to bring to life, for modern readers, the planning and the preparation. The battle and its aftermath, the human dimension of that battle. And it helps people locate their own soldier ancestors in the battlefield. And interesting to see Russell, talk about his ancestors. And I think just about every family has them. So this book critically examines the New Zealand soldiers and their commander's performance in the battle, and really does those findings remain relevant today. So, like Russell, the best is for last. You see this book, your mission now is to buy one. But seriously, I'd like to formally launch this magnificent book, A Taking of the Ridge, The Battle of Mazin's, 1917. Well done, Jeff. It will be treasured. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Grant. Jeff, did you want to take any questions that people might have at this point?
Yes, I've got a few lots still, thanks. So it's, in case you wanted to get away, I thought we'd save the questions to later. Are there any questions, in fact, that you've talked? Yes.
Was the Ridge ever taken back, or was it held for the rest of the war?
Very good question. The Ridge was first taken by the Germans in November 1914, in the Battle of Mazin's 1914. It was taken by the New Zealanders and the British in the Battle of Mazin's 1917. And in April, in the Third Battle of Mazin's 1918, the Germans took it back. And they not only took it back, they kept on going as part of the big German offensive. And they went right back into the British back lines, so way, way back into France before they finally stopped. So that was the third time round. And then in September, October, the British were on their 100 days success. They actually went forward again. And they took Mazin's again, but that wasn't the name of a battle. the amazing thing was that way back in 1914, November, the British had actually managed to go right back off the ridge itself by about 2 kilometres before they were forced back by the Germans. In September 1918, the British finally got back there, and then they stopped because they basically ran out of logistic support. So that was taken 4 times, and there's nothing left. I spoke to the archaeologist, and he said, look, there's not a single brick which is original. It's just been completely flattened. So, totally mind-boggling. Yes?
Jeff, why was that particular area fought over so much?
Well, a lot of that whole area, good question, a lot of the whole area at Mount Edgar was fought over and fought over again. didn't have much time to really get in for the full hour version of the speech, which I'd love to do. It's quite a lecturer. But up in the north part was the plains, the Flemish plain, and that had been flooded by the Belgians to stop the Germans coming through. Further south was a whole lot of heavy industrial towns, and as the Russians are finding out, fighting in towns is never a good idea. So it was going over the ridge, and mission creep gets into the way of things. First up, the Germans wanted to take it so they could head over and take the ports of Dunkirk and further to knock out the British that way. The British decided under Field Marshal Haig that they would actually take out Ostend and the Bruges ports to stop the German U-boats, which wasn't actually necessary, but became, and in the end, then sort of lost the plot completely. It was just about last man standing. But that was the logic. And if you took Messines, because this is the time of which you had to see where the shells were falling, pretty much, up on the ridge you could see where it was going. So if you had the high ground, you could see where the shells were going, and you had the command of the land.
Just remind us how
yes.
The war ends. Why did the Germans surrender
again?
Quickly.
They got knocked off the ridge. It was as simple as that, through artillery. And
but the actual war ended.
Well, the war...
The Kaiser, they got rid of the Kaiser, and they were starving in Berlin, didn't they?
It wasn't just Berlin, it was all over.
All over Germany.
Yeah. And I actually did the calculations with Maurice. We went to have a look in Dresden at the museum, war museum there. By the end, the average German was surviving on the calorie intake of one hamburger, McDonald's hamburger a day. More questions? I think we want to get to the wine, but before we do, could I just say a few final notes? Thank you. Well, first up, thank you everyone for coming this evening. This is a real baby of mine and has been for some time, so it's nice to share it with you. I have to say, I wanted to buy the book. I didn't want to write it. I just wanted to find out what had happened to my own grandfather, what he had done in the battle and lost a chunk of his hand. And the more I researched, the more I found out there was a lot of other people who also wanted to know but didn't know either. So I really wrote it for them. And having finished it 25 years later, they promised Maurice and my wife that we'd get it done for the centennial. I'm very happy to share it and now watch it go on a life of its own. In that regard, could I just sort of say first that thank you very much to the Mayor, Grant Smith, for launching this book. It's very generous to give up your time. Thank you. Also, I'd like to thank the City Library and to Ginny Vera for hosting us this evening. Up there, she's over there. Thank you so much. And, and I have to say that I actually, in my research capacity, I do a lot of work on local government as my day job, and I'm a very, very strong advocate and believer in local government. And although this is a big event for me, it's actually a small one for the council. But the wholehearted support and assistance in this launch and the support that the council does give for local authors is just one example why we actually do need a good and strong local government. And no, I'm not standing for council later. But I actually do believe in local government, and I'm really happy and proud to be able to have it here in the library. Thank you. The research and writing of the book has been a weekend and evenings project largely, but Massey University has been kind and helpful over the years, and I particularly appreciate Glenn, my head of school, who's actually given me time and assistance and support. And I've been taking leave overseas to go and visit archives, so thank you, Glenn. Turning to the book, a lot of people have helped me over the years sort of reading bits and pieces, but in particular, could I just acknowledge tonight, Russell, who's already spoken for the editing, did a great job. He's a nice bloke, but He's actually really horrible with a red pen. You wouldn't think it, but he's actually inside that nice cursive goodness. But I also like to recognise Rob Gibb here. He's now retired from Landcare Research. He gave me so much inspiration and ideas for the mapping. He provided the base work of the LIDAR, which basically translates as being laser radar, let's keep it simple, to actually get incredible accuracy of terrain. About 1 metre square will get you there. And so when you look at the picture, it's just incredible what you can actually see. And the mines are all there and everything. You can really see why people went where they did and why. So thank you, Robert, for a lot of inspiration there and getting me going on that one. Not here tonight, but while you should not judge a book by its cover, you can judge the quality of the book designer by the cover. And I think this is a really incredible work that Lynn Peck has done at Wright Hill. So I'm very grateful. We've done work when I was at the Regional Council with her, which I first met her. And if you look through it, I mean, the text is one thing, but the layout presentations is really quite stunning. But most of all, I'd really like to acknowledge my support team, in particular Marissa, my wife here. Writing is actually a pretty lonely enterprise, but actually being the partner of a writer, I realise that it's even more lonely than that one. However, we've had some pretty memorable times together visiting the battlefields. I don't know if Marissa's quite some enthused with the cemetery bit of it, and archives, where she'd sort of read a book in the morning, realise in the archive, and then we go sightseeing at Lundale or somewhere, or Dresden in the afternoon. But I'm actually under no illusions. Without Maurice, this would not be a book. Thank you.